Good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is Wednesday, February the 21st, 2018, 2/21/18, 14 and a half minutes past the hour. You're tuned into the Now program. I am Scott Spears, back with you for hour number two. Do want to give you some quick programming updates, do some housekeeping here. From hour number one, we want to thank again David Newell, Mr. McFeely, the postman from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, our dear, dear friend here at the station, who was on today celebrating the 50th anniversary of the debut of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood on television. Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood debuted on television February 19th, 1968. David Newell, Mr. McFeely, was there from day one through the show's end on August 31st. 2001. So we thank David Newell for being on. Coming up tomorrow, we continue the celebration of Mr. Rogers. Joe Negri, who was the music director for Fred Rogers for the 40-year history of that show that it was on, or over 30 years, I guess it was, 33 years the show was on the air. And he also played Handyman, portrayed Handyman Negri on the series for those 30 years. He will be along tomorrow to continue to celebrate 50 years of Mr. Rogers. That's at 12:10 tomorrow. And at 1:10, this will be interesting. We're going to be joined by Adlai Stevenson III, a popular, well-known politician in Illinois. Of course, the son of Adlai Stevenson II, who was the governor of Illinois, ran for president twice against Dwight Eisenhower, and worked for the United Nations under President John Kennedy, helped keep us out of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and we'll learn a lot about Adlai Stevenson II from his son, who shares the same name, Adlai Stevenson III, tomorrow at 1:10 p.m. Now, this hour, I hope everybody watched The View on ABC Daytime on Monday. They had a great contest, which they had done last year, and our good friend John DiDomenico, who portrays Donald Trump, won this contest last year. This year, what the contest is, for those of you who don't know, it's impersonations of a political nature, and they do it on President's Day. The gentleman on today was the first person up, and truly, I believe, should have won. He was great. He did impersonations on the show of Presidents Obama, W. Bush, Clinton, Reagan, Carter, Nixon, and Kennedy. Absolutely hilarious. He has a famous mother who's been on this show one time many years ago. Might talk a little bit about that over the next hour. He really should have won Monday. He is tremendous, and I'm so glad we have him here just 2 days later. Jim Meskimen. Jim, how are you?
I'm good, man. How are you?
Doing good. I so enjoyed you on The View on Monday. I loved your impersonations.
Oh, thanks so much. I had a really good time. You know, it really wasn't a hard and heavy contest. And forgive me if you don't hear me terribly clearly. I'm in my car just returning from an early morning event. But, you know, I've been on America's Got Talent, which was much more of a nail biter. This was kind of low key, and you know, I was just happy to be there and to be able to showcase my impressions for a pretty good sized audience.
You know, interestingly enough, Joy Behar has been on this program a couple times, and Joy, of course, a stand-up comedian, and you made her laugh with your impersonation of George W. Bush, and I honestly thought you had won it there, because it's hard to make a comedian laugh.
Well, I think the criterion seemed to be skewing towards stand-up, which I am not, and that is a particular art form that I don't pretend to have mastered. I was there to do the impressions, and I originally pitched them the idea of doing all the presidents all the way back to Hoover in a minute and a half, but they were more interested in having a lot of jokes. So anyway, that's not my strong suit. I tried to make it amusing, but I'm kind of more of a humorist, you know, not like a set up gag guy, as the very fine David Burley is, and he eventually won the contest.
Well, interestingly enough, and nothing against David Burley, I don't think I could hurt him or hurt you or hurt anybody or wouldn't want to. But honestly, when David came out, watching at home, I thought it was between you and I had her name there.
Rosemary,
who's very good. I thought her Barbara terrific. Her Barbara Walters was tremendous.
Oh, stunning. Yeah, it's great. You know, I sort of take impressions for granted a little bit, and I don't really, it's not something that I feel like I'm even a huge fan of in a way, which is funny. But when I hear a great one like that, where it's just on the nose, you're like, wow, that's a little miracle. And her Barbara Walters is just like that. I understand she's also a singer, does a lot of singing impressions. I'd love to hear more of her stuff. She's all over YouTube, so...
Wonderful.
It's just a trip to the laptop.
Well, and you know what was interesting, and I don't want to dwell too much on this, but it was a low-key contest, as you say, but your impressions were so dead on, and I think... Rosemary did not get the choice because, honestly, Barbara Walters is still alive, and I don't think they could have chosen her we've had Hugh Downs on a lot on this program, who's still living.
Uh-huh.
And he always seemed to say he loved Barbara, and I'm sure Barbara's a wonderful woman, but she did not like Baba Wawa. She didn't like that.
Sure.
So I didn't think they could choose her. Because she did, I'm sure they asked her to do that, but that's just my opinion. It's interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought she did a very respectful homage to Barbara and just duplicated the sound so well.
Oh, she
in
did.
A way that wasn't caricatured at all, as many other impressionists I've seen females do Barbara Walden and do the kind of, it's terrific to be here, and that whole accent. But she did something that was a little more... just a duplication. It was quite magical.
If she had been backstage, I would have thought Barbara was there.
It was
amazing. As would I with your impressions. And it was interesting you mention Hoover, because one thing I thought, and I even jotted it down here, you didn't do Johnson, H.W. Bush, or Ford on the program. And I thought, do you do them, or what? I guess you do.
Well, you can actually, if you go to my YouTube channel, you can see I did 10 presidents in a minute and a half, which was the audition tape that I did for The View, and after they didn't buy the routine, I just stuck it up on my YouTube channel, and I do I don't do Trump in that particular one, but I do everything from Obama, and then there's a little bit of a joke at the end with Hoover. I don't actually do his voice, but I do the sound of a Hoover. But I do Kennedy and Johnson and all those ones that you mentioned that I didn't get to do for The View. So,
like Gerald R. Ford is a voice that we really don't hear much of anymore. And even when Chevy Chase did Gerald R. Ford, he didn't attempt to evoke the sound of the man from Michigan. And it's one of those lost ones that I just sort of always have in my back pocket.
Now, H.W. Bush, he does have a distinct speaking voice.
Well, he does. And, of course, Dana Carvey did a terrific job of isolating that kind of nasal twang that he has.
So different from his son George W. You wonder if they even came from the same mother.
It's funny. I forget who said it, but they said the way to do a good H.W. Bush was to take John Wayne and then just tighten his personality up a little bit.
Yeah, it's very good. Yeah, that's right. It's right in that same, because John Wayne is got a certain, particularly when he was younger, a certain timbre. That's very close to George Bush if you just kind of cut it off a little more. You're right.
Yeah, impressions are amazing. When did you realize you had this talent?
Well, I always did it as a kid, but I was a little bit shy about it. And then when I was in my 20s, I moved to New York, early 20s, and started looking for work. And any big city will do this to a kid. You sort of pull out of your bag of tricks anything that you can do to make a buck. And I found that I was able to set myself apart and even get work as a sound-alike, an impressionist for different projects, children's books and promos and eventually radio commercials and animation and stuff. So that was when I realized, you have a certain level of confidence yourself, and then when people start to pay you for it, you get a different level of confidence. You're like, oh yeah, I got this. This is established and this is verified.
How long do you have to listen to somebody to get them down?
It depends. You know, it depends on the quality of the voice. I always say that affinity has a lot to do with it. I have to kind of enjoy or appreciate something or admire something about the person. Otherwise, it's just very hard to want, because you're really embodying them. You're taking on their personality, if just for a moment. And I find that hard to do with people that I don't like, or that I just don't have any feeling for. Also, they're just technically, there are people that are not really within my range. I have a pretty broad range.
I can deepen my voice quite a bit for certain characters, but
there are also very high voices, too, where it starts to sound kind of squeaky. There's a guy I'm working on that I admire very much in his voice, an impression I would love to do, and that's Gary Vaynerchuk. I don't know if your listeners know who Gary Vaynerchuk is. He's an entrepreneur, lives in New York City. In fact, I was just in an event where he's having a pop-up shoe sale of these shoes he's doing for K-Swiss. And Gary V has a very high voice, but it's also very airy and also very, very rapid, very fast, and with a lot of intention behind everything he says. So it's actually quite difficult to do, and I haven't done it to my satisfaction yet, but I'm working on it.
From FDR to Trump, who was the easiest to get?
Well, I'd say the easiest to get, I don't know, I guess everybody was doing Reagan, and I was very familiar with Reagan because when I was starting out as an impressionist, Reagan was president.
So I heard him a lot, and there were a lot of very good impressionists were doing his voice, and we all sort of taught each other, you might say, how to master that particular cadence.
The great Rich Little, of course, still does Ronald Reagan a lot. And but also Jimmy Carter as well. I remember hearing Jimmy Carter on the radio and on television. There was a thing called radio back then. And then what did you say? Oh, FDR. FDR was actually the first thing I ever did professionally, the first presidential voice I ever did for a movie.
And what did FDR sound like?
Well, FDR had a very particular sort of accent and delivery because of the fact that when we hear recordings of his, they usually harken back to an age when the microphones and other means of transmission were so primitive that a man had to cut through with a very definite delivery. And whether he spoke like that in private is really uncertain. But over the radio and in recordings that you can hear in abundance on the History Channel, this is what he sounded like.
You know, that's tremendous. And when I heard you do Carter, much like I said with Rosemary, if Jimmy Carter, if you were behind a drape, I would think that was Jimmy Carter.
It's a good trick. It's a good trick. It's fun. It's fun. And presidents, we hear them so much. That's why they're such ripe fodder for impressionists. They're sort of nakedly out there. They're constantly being, we constantly hear Trump. We constantly hear Obama, and before that, Clinton and Bush.
Well, you
can't escape it.
Well, I always heard, Kennedy, because he has the Massachusetts accent, and Nixon, and people did Reagan and Clinton, but boy, and everybody does a Trump, it seems like now, but Jimmy Carter, I don't even think I'd ever heard Jimmy Carter impersonated, and boy, I thought, he does have a distinct way of speaking.
Oh yeah, he doesn't move his mouth very much at all. He's got his pretty tightly wound down, and very, very, deferential, I would say, is his main characteristic, and gentle as well.
A nice, gentle guy. FDR was tremendous. Did Truman, is Truman easy to do?
Well, he's, I did research because I did Truman's voice for the George Clooney film Monuments Men. Right at the end of the picture, there's an actor playing Truman, but he didn't sound like Truman. He was actually British, and George Clooney wanted that looped. So I got hired to come in and work with George, which was a treat, and create a Harry Truman voice, which was a kind of an Indiana sort of voice, I guess you might say, and really not too different from my own regular voice. I'm just sort of
As you can hear, I'm tightening it up a little bit and giving it a slight Midwestern twang. So I wouldn't say it was difficult, but it was, you know, it's one of those unrewarding ones because very few people remember what Harry Truman actually sounded like.
Well, I think
it's not like one of the bigger ones.
And I think the same thing of Eisenhower. I don't even remember what Eisenhower sounded like.
Oh, I know. I had to look him up, and I always thought he had I'd heard him with a deeper voice somewhere. In my mind, it was deeper, but really, he also just sort of sounded like a gentleman like this, an American man talking. And, you know, often you see these films on YouTube, and they're just talking about very, very pedestrian subjects and in a very careful, conservative way. And you don't really have a picture of what his personality was really like or what he was really like.
Now, then we get to Kennedy. Now, he had it. He had a voice.
Yeah, Kennedy, of course, has been widely imitated over the years. And there's a lot to hang your hat on. You've got the whole, as you mentioned so wisely, the Massachusetts accent. And then, of course, he just had a very forceful way and very articulate way of putting the message across that is well-recorded and well-documented and even revered today in the replayings of these marvelous, marvelous speeches.
Didn't hear Johnson on The View. Johnson had a distinct way of speaking.
No, you didn't hear Lyndon Johnson because that was one of the ones that they axed. But I had it in my repertoire. I have relatives in Texas, so it's not a terrible big chore to pull that out. But indeed, people don't remember too much. They perhaps remember Bryan Cranston more than they do Lyndon Baines Johnson.
And then I think the most widely imitated, Nixon.
That's right, Richard Nixon. Oh, and maybe the most deserving of impression. He was a savage man, brilliant, to be sure, but also, in the end of the day, kind of a super criminal. And so he's rightly lampooned, I think, vocally. Plus, he just had a peculiar way of talking.
What is that with Nixon? What do you make of, I mean, you lived during the time of Richard Nixon. It's not a dialect. What was he doing?
You know, he had a really, I'm not sure. That's a good question. He came from, I think the middle of California.
Yorba Linda.
Yorba Linda, right? I was going to say Yorba Linda. It didn't seem right to me, but you're right. Yorba Linda. And I don't know. You know, when you look at his head, because I look at the physicality of people, it does, I mean, it's the chamber from which a lot of the sound comes from, right? When you're doing a voice. So it's interesting to see what people do with their teeth and how small or how large their noses are. I think it influences sound a lot. Their weight, if they have a lot of, if they're very fleshy. And Nixon just had a really weird melon. You know, that head of his is just, you just don't see that. and then he had a weird, rather than weird, let me say a very individual and unique personality that was, you know, there's a kind of a push-pull with Nixon, isn't there? Because he wanted to do well, he wanted to have an impact, but he also had a little bit of a kink in that intention and wanted to destroy things as well. So there's a kind of a, I don't know, he's like fighting himself a little bit and even it's detectable. It's almost as if he wants to be someone else, like perhaps he wants to sound like Gregory Peck or anyone other than a guy from Yorba Linda.
Well, it's interesting because we all now know because of the tapes and even things he said. He almost had an envy of John Kennedy and the Kennedys. And
sure.
I think a psychiatrist could have had a field day with Nixon.
I imagine they did.
Yeah, if who knows? We've heard Carter and Ford. We heard Reagan and H.W. Clinton, Bill Clinton.
Yeah, also wildly impersonated Bill Clinton. Because he had this peculiar sort of rawness about his voice as if he'd been shouting all night. And maybe he was, I don't know, shouting about something.
But
everyone from Rush Limbaugh to just about everybody has their, drag out their Clinton impression. Some are better than others. I thought Dave Burley did a great job on The View with his Clinton.
Yeah. Now we heard a little bit of it earlier, but I want to hear it again. I said it made Joy Behar laugh spontaneously when you did it. Something about George W. Bush.
Yeah, George W. Bush. I tell you what, he's a beloved figure. he's a
kind of a lovable, I don't know what you'd say, a kind of a clownish politician. I mean, I don't think anyone is, perfect, but George W. Bush is, he seems more human than a lot of people, a little more down to earth.
You know,
I don't know if you've seen his paintings. He's been painting up a storm, and I'm an artist also, and I'm a trained painter. He's not, but his paintings are wonderful. Actually, I think if he had been a painter, it would have been marvelous. But he is now anyway, so that's.
You know what, the thing about Bush, you know, everybody knocked him for everything for a long time, but for me, anytime I would see him, because of the WMDs, he had to use those words a lot, and he would always say nuclear. And I'd say
nuclear.
Oh, right. My goodness.
Nuclear. There's a nuclear threat from our enemy out in the desert. Something's got to be done with that nuclear stockpile. And those weapons of messy destruction.
You know, I kept wondering, doesn't anybody say it's nuclear, not nuclear? I mean, I understand once.
Yeah. Yeah, and then he started to look real gun shy, like, I hope I don't say it wrong. It's coming up. I know I can see it on the prompter. Nuclear. Nuclear.
Nuclear. You know, I had never really thought about it. Maybe I just been out of it, but Obama, he has a unique way of speaking.
He does. He has a very, very, Obama has a pretty much established speech pattern, and a lot of people have caught on to it. It's fine how a person can express almost everything using the same vocal template. But there you go.
Now, do you think that's when you look at these presidents, FDR, as you said, I think correctly or implied, I think his speaking was speech. It was the microphones. He was trying to convey something. The other great communicators, I would say, on this list are probably Kennedy, Reagan, Clinton, and Obama. Do you think they really speak that way?
I don't think they could. It's like any of us. Well, you have to talk in front of a group of people and learn their action when it matters. Like if you're, for most of us, we don't have to go and make speeches about public policy, people's lives, or change the economy if we say things the wrong way. The closest that I ever come to anything like that is if I'm speaking at a memorial, maybe, or at a wedding. You know, and then it matters because it's going to be on video and people care and you don't get a second chance, and it has an impact on people's lives. Well, and my delivery on such an occasion, as perhaps yours is a little more formal, a little more thought out, a little more presentational, let's say, than if you and I are just sitting and talking, and where I can afford to, say things that I don't even want you to hear, or I only want you to hear half of it, or... Well, I'm going to say the opposite of what I mean because we're such good friends. I can say something completely foul, and you'll know that I don't really feel that way. So now at least, you can go online, and you can hear Kennedy talking very candidly. Nixon, of course, did us a great favor. He recorded many, many hours of his most intimate and natural conversations.
But he sounded the same, I thought. Nixon, that just was his voice, I think.
That's true.
Did you think he sounded different on the tapes than when he was out speaking?
Not particularly. I'd say something like, Henry, we got to do something about the Cambodians. It's just getting out of hand. Damn it, Henry. I know, Mr. President, you're right. We have to do something. The nuclear option, that's what I mean. That's what I'm talking about. A nuclear option. But, Mr. President, no, listen to me.
Oh, Kissinger, wonderful. You know what? It really got me thinking about dialects this morning and presidents, because I think probably the four greatest were probably, as I said, Kennedy, Obama, Clinton, and Reagan. But Kennedy and Clinton, there was no pause. They knew what they wanted to say, but they just wanted to say it like they were your friend. Obama and Reagan are similar in that it looks like they're stopping to think while they're speaking.
Right, right. That's a little more theatrical, yeah. Well, Reagan was an actor, so he knew that he knew how to make things natural. Obama, I think, is kind of an actor, too, different sort of actor, like in a way that a lawyer is an actor. He knows that the way he says something has as much to do with it as the words, and he knows how to, I think those things, those little quirks that we hear in Obama where he goes, oh, look, you know, that's a kind of a, I don't know, a sincerity beat that you can insert anywhere, and people will kind of go, oh, this is coming from him, okay, like a little tag.
Well, and I hear that Reagan used to have written into his speeches, well, dot, dot, dot.
Wow, wow.
Yeah, so I don't think it was improv. Well, do you have a Donald Trump?
I do. You know, I think everyone does have a Donald Trump these days. You know, you mentioned John Domenico. Terrific, terrific performer. He's a good friend of mine. I mean, I've never met him, but you understand. He's a very good friend. And I tell you what, he's one of the best. He's very, very good. But you know, I'm a little bit overrun with Donald Trump. It's everywhere, and you really can get away with almost anything with Donald Trump. And I just had too much of it. I don't know. I leave that to the Donald Trump experts.
You know, it's interesting, and nothing to do politically equating here, but I almost think of Trump voice wise in a way like Nixon. They have, it's not dialectic, because nobody else speaks like them, but yet I think it's their voice. I think they speak like that in private, and they are very imitated because of it.
Yeah.
So it's a strange...
They're very unique sound.
Outside of our presidents, being this is President's Day week, what would you consider your best impersonation to be of anybody?
I don't know. There are ones that I really enjoy doing. I'll tell you who I love doing is Tommy Lee Jones, great actor Tommy Lee Jones. He has a marvelous, marvelous way of laying things out and being sort of unemotional or, let's say, dispassionate about a subject. Dismissive is another word that describes him well. It's a lot of fun.
And then there's Sir Ian McKellen as well. I enjoy doing Sir Ian very, very much because it's so different from my own persona. And almost anything which you pronounce as Ian McKellen suddenly takes on dimensions far greater than any normal human bit of conversation, don't you find?
Do you think today, when you look at the 20 and 30 and 40-year-olds who are considered our big stars, one thing I've noticed, they don't speak distinctively, it doesn't seem, or at least not as distinctively as people used to.
Well, that's right. That's right. Well, we're a more homogenized nation. In general, accents are disappearing. Regionalisms are getting kind of blurred. And our movies are so good visually now. They're good sonically as well. But the picture of today compared to the picture of, like, even the 60s when I was growing up, and certainly prior decades, is so crystal clear. It's like the same phenomenon with the recordings and the voices of presidents. You don't have to push so hard. So now, naturally, we have a lot of really good-looking, attractive, healthy-looking, muscular, young leading men who did not come out of radio, and unless they're British, did not come out of the theater, and are chiefly good at, well, let's say their strong suit in many cases is that they can act physically, and that's more important for the style of movies today. If you're doing an Avengers movie or some other movie about a lot of, you know, you need people that can do martial arts. You need people that will look amazing in the glow of a recent explosion or holding the beautiful starlet. So although there are exceptions, but I think in general, we're not in the age of Jimmy Stewart and Humphrey Bogart and these guys that had very distinct regional accents or came from a tradition of radio where they, I don't know, they'd really learned how to use their instrument, I guess.
You know, it's funny when you bring that up, because obviously we're on radio right now and it's just the voice, but when I started in radio, which hasn't been all that long ago, but I still do it today, as I say, good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. And the reason I did that is because when I started in radio, you would always give the time, the temp, and you would, you know, who's on the show today. Well, I just had a short intro music, so I had to go in right away, so I had to give myself the time for the temperature gauge to come up so I could read it. But you keep doing it for some odd reason.
It becomes a signature.
It becomes a signature, and I, at the end, I end with heading to the dugout. Well, that's only because we used to have to signal that we were going out of the program. It wasn't a hard break, so you were just letting them know, get ready, that we're about to play something.
Yeah, there's a lot of holdovers from that time. Don't touch that dial. Even today when we say it's as simple as the click of a button. Meanwhile, nobody's clicking any buttons anymore. We're just sliding our fingers on glass.
Well, the one I heard, it's funny, Hugh Downs told me, he says the greatest thing that he's asked to say when he goes out and does something is, this is today on NBC. Well, the reason they did that is because when they started, everything was tape, and the local stations had to get the commercials ready. So you knew they were getting ready to go to commercial.
Well, Hugh Downs, I remember Hugh Downs' voice very well. It was a kind of a voice that sounded like he his head was still on the pillow.
It very well could have been. Everybody does a Carson. You know, Carson.
That's right. Well, it was Rich Little broke that. He showed the world how to do it. And we've been forever after grateful, the great Rich Little.
I actually got to do Johnny Carson. It's sort of bittersweet. I got hired to do it in a movie, to do Johnny Carson, physically, you know, also the impression, but they got me a wig and got me a suit and flew me to Italy. I worked in Rome, Italy. Johnny Carson on the Johnny Carson show. For a movie about Gore Vidal. It was a lot of fun. I was there for about 8 days in Rome. Even though the set, of course, of the Johnny Carson show is just a few miles away from my home in Burbank, I got to go to Rome to do this video or this film. Unfortunately, it'll never see the light of day because the guy playing Gore Vidal is Kevin Spacey.
Oh.
So that was that.
Yeah, that'll do it.
Bit of bad luck, bit of good luck. Anyway, that's how it goes.
You know, it's interesting. What do you make of all that? Because, you know, your mother, which we'll talk about here in a minute, I'm going to save it. I'm going to let them think about it a little bit more. But she's been on this program, a very kind woman. We'll just say that she's had a lot of happy days. We'll talk about her in a minute.
Yeah.
But
her book is coming out, too, if I can plug her book.
Absolutely.
Her book is coming out March 24th. Her autobiography is called My Days, Happy and Otherwise. You can pre-order it now on Amazon. A wonderful story of her life growing up in Minnesota and becoming a young starlet in Hollywood and working with people like Noel Coward and Cary Grant and Clark Gable. And, oh, my God, it's an incredible story before Happy Days. And then the Happy Days years are amazing, too.
And, of course, she's done a lot of... Marion Ross, of course, is who we're talking about. That's your mother. What was it like having Marion Ross as a mother?
Well, you know, she was a working actress and not home a lot, and a single mom also. After I was about 8 years old, she and my father were divorced. So she had a really tough row to hoe. She raised two of us, my sister and I, in Tarzana. And she made movies as an actress. She never backed down. She did guest spots. She did commercials. And always trying to get the brass ring of series regular. Luckily, Gary Marshall agreed that, you know, she would be a perfect mom. And that changed our lives. But she was a lot different before Happy Days, in a way. Because she was so stressed out. I think it was knowing, as a parent now, of just the one daughter, my wife and I, too, we're not divorced. We've been married for 30-plus years. It's tough. And if you're making a living as an actor. So I have a lot of admiration for her. Once Happy Days really started to become a phenomenon, which wasn't until about 3 years in, then she started to really come into her own, really blossom, and she became and is just a spiritually uplifting, creative, unserious delight. Anybody that meets her is just falls in love with her because she's just legitimately marvelous.
It's interesting. A few years ago, and it sounds like the title of her book kind of leads into this. A few years ago, Charlotte Ray, of course, who was Mrs. Garrett on The Facts of Life, wrote a book. And what I found fascinating, and we had her on at the time, was she really let it all out. We didn't know that Charlotte had a son who was disabled, that she wasn't particularly thrilled with Facts of Life. That's why she left. She liked the girls, but she just didn't want to do television anymore. Did you learn anything? Are we going to learn anything from the Marianne Ross book? That
you absolutely are. You absolutely are. Yeah, you're going to learn some amazing things and some things you didn't know, and behind the scenes stuff. And she's not a sensational writer that wants to spill a lot of secrets. She's not gossipy at all. But there are some things that she is very frank about regarding other members of the cast and about her marriage and other people that she came in contact with. And, you know, it's lovely that she could do that. She does it in a very kind and sincere and loving way. But I think readers will be impacted by it, yeah. And she said, you know, everybody who is significant, any celebrity, any great actor, great figure, you know, they've got a whole life just like you do. And they've got neighbors and relatives, and they've got old girlfriends and wives and husbands and situations and problems. It's planet Earth, you know. Nobody, just because you're a celebrity doesn't mean you live in Valhalla where everything is just going smoothly and you're just, you know, uniformly adored all day long. It's a challenge to live in this world. And these people that we admire are people that have bested some corner of it and have, you know, despite everything, created their art or, you know, maintained their integrity in some way or dazzled us, you know, with their skill and their artistry. And Mom is like that. She's persevered. She's represented something that is, you know, that is very iconic and very needful, I think. It's this kind of friendly, supportive, maternal character that I've talked to a lot of people. They all wish, God, I wish she had been my mom. Or I feel like, people always tell her, I feel like you raised me.
You know, it's interesting when I think of Marianne Ross. I think this great long run that was Happy Days. But I mean, we all know the big, we don't know the inside, but we know the big stories of that show about Henry Winkler and Ron Howard having, you know, they wanted to change the title of the show. And of course, we know about the sad ending to Aaron Moran and Scott Baio and his own troubles. So, you know, but everybody has those. They're just, I guess, not as front and center.
Yeah. Yeah, everybody's got something. It's a full life, and our life has many dimensions. And there's no, you know, no one turns around and goes, "Well, I've got everything all lined up. Everything is perfect." If you do, you're usually looking behind you for the axe to fall, or above you, perhaps.
Yeah, we have about 7 minutes left, and I want to touch on this again. What is your mom's book's title is, and when is it
released?
Yeah,
it's called My Days. Happy and Otherwise by Marianne Ross. It releases March 24th. You can pre-order it now on Amazon. And I wish you would, because you know what? I'd love for her to have a bestseller for Mother's Day. I think it would be really sweet.
Oh, I tell you, extend the invitation. We'd love to have her back. That'd be a lot of fun.
I will.
To have her back on the
program. And I have my own series, television series. It's called Impress Me, which is about Impressionists and features myself and Ross Marquand, who is now part of the cast of The Walking Dead, plays Aaron on The Walking Dead. And he and I starred in this show that was on cable for a second, and now will be streaming on Amazon Prime starting March 1st. And that's called Impress Me. And that's a really fun show with a lot of very... If you love impressions and impressionists, you will love this show because we got bunches of them.
Perfect. I love it. With about 4 minutes left, where we were going earlier on, you know, this whole Hollywood thing with Kevin Spacey and a whole lot of other people, when I talk to somebody about it, what I always hear is, well, everybody knew that this stuff was going on. Your mother's been involved in Hollywood. You've certainly been around it. Did everybody know? Is that a true statement?
No, I don't think everybody knew. But certainly more people knew that would have been close to someone like Kevin Spacey. Obviously, Harvey Weinstein is sort of the poster child for out ethics behavior, and a lot of people knew about that because he affected a lot of people. You know, at the end of the day, your behavior will catch up with you. One's behavior, one's acts, good and bad, you know, they come home to roost. And your reputation can be built up in many ways, but if it's built on a foundation of truth and positivism, you know, and being a genuinely, legitimately good person, helpful person, benevolent person, that's going to show. People are going to know it. Like in the case of my mom, she's got a great reputation. It's the love of God. So truly is. It's not just on the surface. Other people can paint a picture of being nice, private, or what they do under pressure comes back to haunt them. It's always there.
Was mom supportive of you getting in the business?
Totally. Totally. She's always been supportive of me and my sister as artists. Whether I was a cartoonist or a painter or an actor, she's always been right there. She's just great that way. I wish everyone had a mother like that or a father that was supportive and said, "That's marvelous. What you're doing is great. Yes, keep going."
Now, is Meskimen, is that your father's last name?
Yeah, that was my father's last name. It came from McSimmons. There are certain Meskimens. There's even a Meskimen's Law, I find. And to my horror, it applies to me. Meskimen's Law is, there's never time to do it right, but there's always time to do it again. So, if you want to do this interview again, we can.
I would love to. So far in your career, what would you consider the high to be?
Apollo 13. I was in Apollo 13. Ron Howard, my good friend Howard, put me in that movie, and such a great film, and I've got to work on it a month. I learned a lot. I had a great experience, and it continues to be a great work of art to be involved in.
How many people come up to you and say, "Your mom's Marianne Rush, you're friends with Ron Howard, can you get my screenplay to them, can you get my audition tape to them?"
A few. And I can't. I can't get my own stuff to him, but he's really risen up the ladder, boy. He's become top of the top now. The latest Star Wars.
Who were you most excited to meet? Being in a show business.
Five films with him.
Being in a show business family, who have you been most excited to meet? Who did you really like meeting?
Oh, God. I was just thinking about this the other day. I happened to meet, I didn't meet him, but I was in the same room with Paul McCartney. And that made me feel good for a week.
I bet.
It was magical. I would love, wouldn't it be great to have that kind of reputation and career where if someone just happened to run into you, they felt good for a week?
That's pretty good. You know,
That's pretty good.
But two and a half minutes, not to get the jump on your mom's book, but what's something you learned about your mom from reading that book that you didn't know?
Oh, there's some cute little things about her childhood in Minnesota that I was unfamiliar with. And, she really paints the picture of being a kid she was the middle child. She always says she's the middle child. It brings that up as an important factor. And she had a little touch of larceny, always. She was trying to work. She was trying to game the system. She was trying to hack things from early on. And I love that because I recognize that in myself and also in my daughter. We're always trying to work it a little bit, and if we got to bend the rules a little, it's okay.
Yeah. Was there anybody you ever met who you just, it wasn't the greatest experience?
Well, yeah, but I mean, I wouldn't want to talk about it really. You know, I've met so many, mostly the stars that I've met have been fantastic. Ed Harris, Martin Landau, Tom Hanks, these people, they're just great people, you know, and Ron Howard, Henry. I've been very, very fortunate. You know, there's a few stinkers here and there, but by and large, most of the people that are famous and that are well thought of and well considered and competent in their field are that way for a reason. They're in control of their lives, and they're damn good at what they do.
1 minute left. We have a question here, and I want you to tell when your series is going to be out again. But the question is, what was Tom Bosley like, your mom's on-screen husband?
You know, very friendly guy to me, always very cordial. Yeah, not too much to say about Tom. But I'll tell you about my series.
I want you to do it.
Impress Me, streaming on the Soul Pancake channel on Amazon Prime. Soul Pancake is Rainn Wilson's channel from The Office. Anyway, you can probably just find it by typing in Impress Me on Amazon Prime. You can stream it starting March 1st. We've got 13 episodes, season one. Ross Marquand, Dana DeLorenzo, Christina Bianco, some wonderful impressionists and actors. And it's a nice story, directed and written by Ben Shelton.
Jim Meskevin, great actor, impressionist, great guest on this program. As I say, invite your mom back. We'd love to have her, and thank you so much for coming on.
You bet. Look at my YouTube channel if you want some fun stuff, too.
I will certainly do that. Jim Meskevin, thank you so much.
You betcha.
Bye-bye. And that's all the time we have for today. This is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
Mother Goose.
Did you?
Yes.
Well, tell us about that.
Well, there was nothing to tell. I was dressed up like Mother Goose. I was in this thing. Say I had a secret.